History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold if we'll just take the initiative to ask a few questions of some of our more seasoned neighbors, and more importantly, take the time to patiently listen to what comes back our way. Our goal is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, it's not just that we're entertained, but so often we truly are inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today you're going to hear the memories of two men who have most certainly inspired me over the years, two men who both happened to be on the receiving end of Imperial Japan's surprise attacks that drew the United States into World War II, and two men who both happened to celebrate their 101st birthdays earlier this week on the same day. The COVID-19 pandemic tempered the celebration in Albuquerque, New Mexico for Bill Overmyer, as it did in Central California for Frank Paredes. But by the end of this hour, I think you're going to be amazed that these two survived World War II, let alone the amazement that these two centenarians are still with us. February 15th, 1920 is the day these two entered the world. And while Bill Overmyer, who you're going to hear from in a bit, was taking his first breaths in Illinois, Frank Paredes was born into a family of 18. Yes, he was one of 16 kids born to a Mescalero Apache family in the Dragoon Mountains in southeastern Arizona, not too far from Tombstone. He was injured while working in a copper mine there at age 16, and at age 21 in September 1941, he enlisted in the Army.
They sent me to Hawaii. I was on my way to Manila to join the troops in Manila. So I was waiting in Pearl Harbor, Schofield Barracks, actually, on a cadre to go, waiting for more people to show up to go to Manila. But that's when I got caught, you know. Incidentally, a friend of mine, his name was Max Druin. He went in the Navy, and I went in the Army. He was aboard the USS West Virginia. I was in Schofield Barracks. So on Saturday night, December the 6th, I went to Pearl Harbor to visit with him. And we had a few beers, you know, and chatted, you know, about the hometown and this and that. I told Max, I says, I got to catch the last shuttle to Schofield Barracks. Otherwise, I'll be stranded here, you know. And I do help the priest say Mass on Sunday mornings. So I caught my shuttle, went back, and I made it okay. 8 o'clock, about 5 minutes to eight, I was on my way to church for Mass, and all of a sudden I heard a big noise, and the sirens went off, and they says, this is not a drill, this is not a drill. All personnel report to your stations. I didn't have a station, but we did have machine guns set up, you know. So what I did, I manned the first machine gun that I could find, and it was a Twin 50 on a Heinz mount. I spotted this torpedo bomber. It was probably about maybe 150, 200 feet up in the air. I could see the pilot, and I took a burst at him, and I missed him. Then I gave him a lead, and then I took another burst at him, and I smoked him. I don't know whether he went down, but I'm pretty sure he did went down because he started going towards the ocean. So that's where everything went haywire. So I start picking up, fighting fires, helping out, you know, with whatever I did. And I helped for about maybe 7 or 8 days. And then I got on, they put me on a ship, and I was on my way to Australia.
Well, let me come back to that, because I want to, before we get too far past it, I want to ask you about that time on Oahu. Because you described it, and I know you lived it, and you probably tell these stories a few times. But you're a 21-year-old kid. You're on your way to Mass, and all of a sudden, World War II begins for America, and you're right there in the thick of it, and you hop on a machine gun, and shoot a Japanese plane. What did this feel like? Because I imagine that's a pretty big shock to your system, that all of a sudden you're at war and the world is crazy. How did you deal with that?
I know it was crazy. So I joined the military for one thing and one thing only, to do what I had to do for my country. And that's what I did.
Was it scary for you in that moment? I mean, this is day one. I mean, you knew maybe something was going to happen at some point, but now it's actually here right in your face.
Yeah, it was scary. But the way I figured, you live one day at a time. And that's the way it went, you know, all through my military life.
And you said you were helping out for 7 or 8 days in the aftermath of the Japanese attack. And there aren't a whole lot of people left with us anymore that actually saw those things with their own two eyes. What are some of the things that you saw and experienced in those days following the attack that you still remember today, that in when you close your eyes, you can still picture exactly what that looked like?
Well, to me, you know, I still have dreams about that. And those dreams, you know, make you, to me, they make you go on and on, live your life as you want to live it.
Were you around Schofield Barracks cleaning up, or did you go down to the harbor and help with pulling bodies out of the water and all that?
Yes, I went to, I started pulling bodies, limbs, you know, arms, legs, you know, and heads, and it was awful. Thinking about it, you know, it makes me cry. The poor people, innocent people that got caught in a turmoil like that.
And I know there are other moments, because this is just the start of the war and you were in for a while, but when you think back specifically about December 7th, is there part of you that says, yeah, I could have been one of those more than 2,000 that died there?
Yes, I lost a few friends. I lost, especially in Schofield Barracks, I lost a few friends there. And then aboard the USS Arizona, I lost a cousin. His name was William Webb. So when I went back to Pearl Harbor in 1990, I went to the memorial, and there was Japanese people going to the USS Arizona, and they were speaking in Japanese, and they were descendants of the pilots that had bombed Pearl Harbor, because, you know, I had a lot of Japanese friends here before the war. And I learned a little bit about Japanese, you know. I could understand some of it, but not all of it. But they had, you know, people there too, you know, wanted to go see the memorial. And then the memorial, you could still see oil coming out. And I think that'll go on forever, because there's a lot of people that are buried there, you know, underwater.
Is your cousin one of them?
Yes.
And at the time, back in 1941, I'm sure there was some uncertainty at first. You guys didn't know who had survived, who hadn't. When did you find out that your cousin had died, and what did that do to you?
I found out that when after the war, I went to my cousin's, to his mom, you know. Her name was Clotilde. She says, I'm very proud of my son. He died a hero. Anyway, that's about all I can remember about him, you know. But getting back to picking up bodies, parts of bodies, taking them, you know, to grave registration, it took a while, you know, to get everything, you know, squared away.
When I talk to guys who are at Pearl Harbor, and I talk to guys who just served in the war, period, remember Pearl Harbor. I mean, it was three words that seemed to hold a lot of weight for them. For you, as you go on, and we're going to hear some of your adventures in the rest of the war, how big of a motivation was what you had seen and experienced at Pearl Harbor? What did Remember Pearl Harbor mean to you?
It meant to me that Remember Pearl Harbor, keep on going and give them hell. And that's what we did.
But one of the first ways he did that was rather unexpected. You heard him mention he had been headed to Australia, and that's where he was in May of 1942.
After the Battle of the Coral Sea, we weren't getting no supplies. No, the Air Force asked for volunteers, and I volunteered to be a machine gunner on a B-25 and going towards Port Moresby to make a bombing run we got one of our wings shut off, so we had to bail out. That was my first parachute jump.
So you're in the Army, but you're still not assigned to any division or outfit, right? And they wanted volunteers to go on B-25s?
They needed a gunner. Everything was going to Europe at the start of the war in the Pacific. So Europe was getting all the supplies, and they needed a volunteer gunner. That was the 5th Air Force. So I volunteered, and as we were making our run over Port Moresby, New Guinea, anti-aircraft or guns, you know, start shooting at us, and they blew part of our wing off. So the pilot says, get ready to bail out. I had never bailed out.
Well, you haven't had any aerial training at all, right?
No, I've never had any aerial training at all.
Doesn't that sound a little ridiculous to you?
Right. But, I mean, I enlisted to do what I had to do. Yeah. So I bailed out. Everybody got safe. The plane crashed naturally, you know, because we abandoned the plane. But we landed in the water, and we were there for a couple of hours. But we had Mae West life jackets, and we had a vial that you squeezed it, and they would send out phosphorus. That was a shark repellent. There were sharks there, that was for sure. But in about 2 hours later, we got picked up by a PT boat, and they sent us back to Cairns. We got checked out and everything. So anyway, then I joined the 32nd Infantry Division, which was a Wisconsin National Guard. I joined the 126th Regiment, crossing the Owen Stanley Range. We were on the way to Buna Gona, but we were on the Kokoda Trail, and there was nothing but couldn't carry trucks or anything like that, you know. It was all pulled by horses. So anyway, we weren't getting any supplies or anything, you know. So we ran out of food. We got a lot of malaria, dysentery, dengue fever, fighting all the elements. And we were hungry. So we started eating horse meat till we got to Kokoda. And then we went all the way to Buna Gona. And Buna and Gona were still held by the Japanese. And I think the Navy did a lot of bombarding and this and that, you know. When I got to Buna Gona, they asked for volunteers because I had been, you know, in the ocean, you know. There was a new outfit which was called Special Amphibious Brigades. So I joined the 2nd Amphibious Brigade, and that's when I started making landings, you know, landing troops on D-Day landings. So I was assigned to the 1st Marine Division, and we did a lot of small landings and some big landings, too. And we also supplied the Coast Watchers. So anyway, one of my friends, he got caught by the Japanese, and they beheaded him.
Where was that?
That was in New Guinea.
And I'm sure that had to be really hard for you to deal with, and it probably also tells you what would happen to you if you got caught, right?
That's it. You know, a lot of people don't believe that I ran into people, Japanese people, using babies in the Philippine Islands for bayonet practice. There's two Japanese people who pick up this kid, you know, maybe 4 or 5 years old, even babies, toss him up in the air, and the Japanese guy would come and stab him. And that was hard to do, to watch that, you know. So I remember one time in New Guinea, I got into a hand-to-hand combat with one. It was a boy, but I don't think he was 17 years old. And he wasn't, I don't know, maybe he was suicidal or whatever. But he did get me a little bit. But I said, sorry, but it's you or me. And I got him.
You mentioned making beach landings. What were the beach landings that you were involved in?
The one that I remember the most was in Cape Lasser, New Britain. We went in there with the 1st Marine Division and the 32nd Infantry Division, the 126th Regiment. We landed them, came back, took another load of Marines and infantry, took them in, and then we wait for people to bring dead and wounded. Then I pick up the dead and the wounded and take them to the hospital ship, which was, you know, laid out, you know, offshore. Take them, unload them, and then go back and get another load. It would be maybe 10, 12 trips.
On what? On a LCVP or?
They were LCMs. My number was 696. I'll never forget that because, you know, it got full of holes, you know, by machine gun fire, you know, but we made it all right.
Well, and you mentioned machine gun holes, and I know that that duty to bring out the dead and wounded had to be very taxing emotionally, but you mentioned machine gun holes, and you told me you were wounded three times during the war. Where were those three occurrences? Tell me about them.
Once I got wounded in New Guinea, and the one that was going to treat me, he was a medic. The Marines called him corpsman, you know, but We called him medics. Called the medic, and when he came out to take care of me, he got shot. I got picked up with somebody else, I don't know who, and they took me to a hospital. They sent me back to Australia. I was in the hospital in Australia for a while. They took care of me good, you know, and then they sent me back to my unit.
Tell me how you got hit. What was happening at the time? How did it all unfold?
It was a bonsai attack. Japanese, you know, they pulled a bonsai on you whenever they could.
So you're in a defensive position and all of a sudden a bullet from somewhere hits you? Where?
Oh, I got hit in the leg. In fact, I have a silver kneecap.
And then you call a medic and then he gets killed trying to help you out. I mean, what goes through your head in a situation like that? It sounds pretty desperate to me.
Yes, but I mean, you know, I says, this wound is going to send me home. No way. They needed us over there.
And that was just the first time he was wounded. We'll hear about the other two when we come back, and also hear the story of yet another World War II survivor who turned 101 this week. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. When life throws you curveballs, you have to be adaptable, or at least have a good pinch hitter on the bench who knows how to handle a curve. When it comes to your business, Provident Payments is the best teammate you could ever have. Perhaps it helps that many of the leaders for one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America are former ballplayers. Contactless payments, online ordering, point of sale, you name it, Provident Payments knows it. Now, you could get some of these services from one of the big banking companies, but you're never going to get the kind of personalized service that Provident Payments delivers every day. 24/7 solution-based tech support. When your ability to process payments goes haywire in any way, time is money. So would you rather wait on hold for who knows how long, or would you like to have a direct line you can call for immediate help? That's where a good teammate comes in. Learn more about bringing Provident Payments onto your team at providentpayments.com. They really are one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. That website again, providentpayments.com.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes. Celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, celebrating two amazing veterans who both marked their 101st birthdays on February 15th. We'll hear from Albuquerque, New Mexico's Bill Overmeyer in a few moments, but first we have to finish up with Frank Paredes, who told us about the first time he was wounded in World War II, but not the second or third times.
The second time was in the Philippine Islands. That was in Tacloban, Leyte. We landed in Tacloban, Leyte, and across was an island, Samar. And on my boat, I picked up a dead Japanese dead body in between the propellers. So I had to pull in the beach and tie my boat up, you know, and get under water and change propellers. But first chopped the body out. It was tangled in both the propellers. So I chopped them out. In the meantime, while the guy was giving me oxygen in my mask, we get a raid, you know, and he pulled the cord, you know, told me that meant a signal for me to get up, you know. So a bomb hits, I'd say maybe about 100, 150 feet. But the concussion on the water, you know, it hurt my ears. That's not when I got wounded. That's when I got up. When I got out, you know, and I was going to try getting my boat off the beach. So I manned my machine gun. And here comes a zero strafing. And one of the bullets got into the cockpit and went circled, you know, round and round. And it hit me here, went around, hit the well deck. Yeah. I mean, the cockpit, hit another one. And then I got another one back here.
So you got hit on the right rib cage and in the left side of your back, kind of almost simultaneously.
But I mean, that Japanese Zero didn't last very long. Because the Navy was there, you know, and the Air Force were there. In fact, I'm lucky that I got out of there because there was bullets flying all over the damn place.
Well, yeah, and it seems to me if you get hit on your side and in your back, there's a lot of organs in there that could have been damaged by that. You're probably pretty fortunate to have survived that.
Right. So anyway, I did get my third wound.
Well, let's finish up the second one first. How bad was it? How much pain were you in? And
I was in a lot of pain, you know, but I had, you know, some sulfanilamide powder, and I had a bandage, you know, had a first aid kit, and I had morphine, give a shot, you know.
You had to take care of yourself.
I took care of myself, yes. Took care of my wounds, and I was fine.
Did you at all consider the possibility that you might not make it out of that?
Yes. I said, maybe this is my time to go. But the big boy up there, you know, he took care of me.
It sure sounds like it. And so that was in the Philippines on Lady. And then you said a third time you were wounded. Where was that, and how'd that happen?
The third time was in the Philippines again. That was in Ormoc, you know, that was across the Tacloban on the other end of the island.
Ormoc, sir, there's a big horseshoe kind of bay there, right?
Yeah, right. So I got wounded there, too. The same thing, you know, on the boat, you know.
So you're still operating this LCM, and it was aircraft fire again?
Yes. When I got wounded there, I landed on the beach, and I dug in. My LCM, you know, was broached. Couldn't pull it out. So I had to abandon it, went on the beach, and then I dug a hole, you know, in the sand, and then a bomb fell about from here to my van, and I got blown up in the air about maybe 15, 18 feet. And I come back down, and then on the way down, I got hit with a piece of shrapnel right here.
Right under your chin. So the bomb hits 50 feet away, you go sky high, and on your way down, something slices you on the top of your neck, bottom of your chin?
The doctor, he says, Sergeant, he says, I can't operate on you because it's too close to your jugular vein. Says eventually, hopefully, it's going to travel, and it's going to travel away from your jugular vein. So when I got out about maybe 40 years later, I started getting a toothache. So I went to the dentist. He took x-rays. He said, you got a piece of metal, he says, in your root canal. Says your tooth has got to be pulled. So he pulled it. And sure as heck, there's a little chip of shrapnel.
So 40 years later, this little, how big would you say, like fingernail size piece of shrapnel?
I'd say about half of a match hit on the matchstick. Okay. It's just a little chip.
He pulls that out of your mouth 40 years later. That you must have gotten quite the kick out of that.
My wife got a kick out of it. I didn't want that as a souvenir. That's why I have 12 shoppers now.
Uh-huh. Let me ask you about Honor Flight. What was it like for you to go on this plane with all these other veterans and go see that World War II memorial?
To me, it was beautiful. We were treated like royalty. We had the best of everything. What got me the most, you know, because as a rule, I was Army, but mostly, you know, I feel myself being a Marine because most of my, you know, was with the Marines. So the Marine Memorial reminded me of my brother, my friends, the people that I knew in the Marine Corps, and especially the code talkers. The other one was Arlington National Cemetery. because I have two people, real good friends of mine, buried there. One is Junior Vinvoise. He got killed in New Guinea. He got the Medal of Honor. And the other one was a real, real good friend of mine, Frank Chavez. He got the Medal of Honor, too, from Anthony, New Mexico. I promised him that I would go visit his family if I made it. So that's what I did. You know, when I got home, I went to Anthony, New Mexico, and met Frank Chavez's family. And that was the hardest thing I had to do. I went and told him, you know, this is a message from your son. He died like a man, and he died a hero.
Another one of Frank's heroes is his late brother, Raul, who volunteered for the 1st Marine Patrol to reach the summit of Mount Suribachi on Iwo Jima. Frank Paredes is a veteran of the Korean War as well, who has spent decades putting his love for his country on display to any and all who would listen. And last week, just before his 101st birthday, Frank received his COVID-19 vaccination. The same day Frank celebrated birthday number 101 in California, Bill Overmyer was the man of the hour at a parallel celebration in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Bill had signed up for the National Guard to earn some extra cash. While he was studying engineering at the University of New Mexico, he was called to active duty and sent to the Philippines with the 200th Coast Artillery. He was in an anti-aircraft battery protecting Clark Field when the Japanese attacked.
We had rumors that Hawaii had been hit. Some of the guys said, yeah, well, we're going to fight them, but it'll take 6 weeks or so, and we'll clean their plow. Well, it didn't take any 6 weeks, and it took much longer, and it was everything we could do to survive. But the whole darn thing had to do with our forces in Washington, D.C., our brains resolving a conflict with Japan. And this had been going on for several years. We were sending scrap metal, selling scrap metal to Japan. Japan had ambitions. They had beaten the Russians at a naval conflict, and they were confident that they could get what they wanted. They needed oil. They needed steel. They needed knowledge. They'd sent their military men to the United States, and the United States taught them how to fight a war. Mm-hmm. Well, no kidding. That's what happened at Pearl Harbor. Guess what? They used that same lecture to bomb Pearl Harbor. So we knew that things were going to change.
And a lot of people don't realize that war ensued simultaneously in the Philippines when it hit Pearl Harbor, that you guys were under attack basically the same day, right?
That's correct.
Clark Field was hit that same day, although...
It was December the 8th, but it was after the Asiatic Pacific line.
The international date line.
Right.
So it's December 8th in the Philippines, December 7th in Hawaii, but it's the same day you guys are hit.
Roughly 8 hours after Pearl Harbor was hit. We were there all ready for action, and here came some planes over. We heard some planes. We looked up. We saw some ghosts up there. There was 54 of them. We could count them. And they were flying right overhead. Now, was that our plane? We thought it was Navy. And we didn't do anything until we heard some bombs whistling through the air. And here came the bombs. Man alive. Anyway, couldn't wait to commence fire. So we took our readings with our height finder and information to the M4 director. To the guns, fire 4 rounds each. That'd be 16 rounds. I gave the order to do that. Well, they fired. The darn things went off about 1,000 feet below the airplanes. After 9 months of training and teaching how to shoot at a target of an airplane, we got into action and we found out that our fuses were World War I fuses, powder train fuses. Believe it or not, they sent us right into the teeth of the enemy with unprepared. Incidentally, we had World War I helmets, steel helmets. We had World War I Springfield rifles, bolt action, 5 shots, and how many more things I can't even think of. We thought we had some pretty nice guns, but they did shoot out pretty fast, about the same velocity as a rifle did. And we thought we knew everything there was to know, but we got an education.
Well, and that's what I'm curious to know, what that felt like that day. Because here you've been preparing for it. You know there's a possibility. Then when war's actually there, it's on your doorstep, it's right in your face, and you're firing at the enemy, and the enemy's bombing you. Did that change anything for you emotionally, mentally? Do you remember what that was like?
It filled us with despair. After the bombers dropped, dive bombers came in, and they started strafing and shooting up different areas. Their main targets were the airport, Clark Field, and the buildings, and quite a few of our soldiers were killed in the mess hall and in the buildings and so forth. But we were out in the open in a dug-in trench. Incidentally, anybody that joins the Army or the military ought to learn how to dig a hole in the ground, because that's the safest place you can be. Absolutely. Well, anyway, these dive bombers were coming around strafing, and we had two machine guns in our battery, and one of the guys that was a football player from Texas Tech was on my staff, my range staff. He was up on top shooting at the planes with his little handheld machine gun, but he didn't hit anything. We were all shooting with our rifles, or some guys were shooting with their pistols, but we didn't shoot any other planes down until the second day. We were in the north runway of Clark Field, it's clear down at the end, and we were dug in. We had our 4 3-inch guns dug in, the M4 director and the stereoscopic height finder. Incidentally, I was the chief of range section of the aiming, you might say, of the 4-inch guns, and that's the M4 director was the brains for the whole thing. Now, this is before radar.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, we discovered that battery A had been issued some radar, and after they hit us there the first day of war, the second day, three planes came in and they were flying low. The radar told us, got three boys coming in such and such 1,000 feet. So we matched pointers until we could see them. And then we went visual. They were coming right straight at us. So I turned in. I was on the M4 director. I entered a little correction on the M4 and shortened the target range and the guns going off so the explosions would be in front of them. They'd have to fly through it. We got two out of the three. The best shooting we had during the whole dang war.
And if you hadn't made that adjustment, you might have gone 0-3.
That's right. We were not at Clark Field much longer. A matter of days, in fact. We stayed there at Clark Field another day or so, I guess. Then they moved us out and said, we're moving to Bataan. Well, what's Bataan? Bataan is a peninsula hanging off of the bottom of the main island of Luzon. We went south and we set up for a day or so up at a main bridge at a big river that was just before you get into Bataan. It was a key bridge to allow soldiers from all over the Luzon and the Philippine Islands. They converged at that area roughly and then settled and retreated back into Bataan to make a stand against the Japanese. We had thousands of soldiers making that retreat, and they had to go over this river. Mm-hmm. And we knew the Japs were going to want to blow it up.
The bridge up so you couldn't cross the river.
So we protected it.
If not for a twist of fate, he would have ended up on the Bataan Death March, and we might not have had the privilege of hearing his story, much less wish him a happy 101st birthday. You can go to hometownheroesradio.com for photos and more relating to the two birthday boys we're honoring this week. And Hometown Heroes. We'll be right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, honoring two men this week who just celebrated their 101st birthdays. Both experienced the first day of American combat in World War II, albeit in two very different places. If you ever pass through Las Cruces, New Mexico, the Bataan Death March Memorial there is one of the most moving memorials I've ever seen. There were more men from New Mexico on the death march than from any other state. Bataan Memorial Park in Albuquerque is also worth your time, and Bill Overmeyer knows both of those spots very well. He also knows that he easily could have ended up on that infamous march that claimed thousands of lives.
The day before Bataan fell, I was walking someplace in the banana grove with a friend of mine from here. We looked up. Gosh, there's a plane. Well, he's got his motor off. He's coasting down. And I could have thrown a rock at him. If I'd had my rifle, I could have shot him and got him. My rifle was back where I left. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you shouldn't do that. You should never lose your rifle. And my buddy, he'd done the same thing. So this plane dropped a bomb. And we hit the ground, and the bomb went off on the other side of my friend. And he got a terrible shrapnel in his leg. They hauled him off to the hospital. He had malaria already. He never made it. Mm-hmm. His dad was a dentist here in Albuquerque.
You mentioned Bataan falling, and I've heard a lot of stories of the lead-up to that from different survivors that I've talked to where they mentioned things like you said, that the provisions were World War I era defenses, guns, they were low on ammunition. And then the food supply, there was a shortage of food, didn't have a whole lot to eat. Were you guys starting to experience some of that?
Yes, we were. We were down to half rations, and then they got us down to quarter rations. We found out, I didn't know why we didn't have any food. I found out that when the trucks left Clark Field to retreat to Bataan, they forgot to get the food.
Wow.
We had food stores galore at Clark Field, and the Japs got to use them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's real admirable. It wasn't our responsibility, but I don't know whose it was. But anyway, we had a crew out that would go for game. First, we ate carabao. It was a form of steak. We ate horse meat. The Philippine Scouts were a cavalry unit before
right.
we ever got there. Well, we got to eat their horses.
Wow. Well, desperate times, desperate measures.
I ate monkey meat.
Mm-hmm.
I ate iguana.
This is all before you were a prisoner?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes, before we got on our way to Bataan.
Uh-huh.
Or after. Same thing, basically. Anyway, we were eating monkey meat, and rice ration was down to something like a quarter of a pound per day or something like that. And And we started losing weight. And when we got to Bataan, we were set up in a banana grove, and we used to eat the bananas. They were about 4 inches long, and they were sweeter than pineapple. Boy, they were good. But I've never eaten an American banana because they're nothing like those.
Can't compare to those ones all those years ago, huh?
No way.
Had you heard at this point, as Bataan's about to fall, you're realizing you're in another desperate situation. Did you guys hear at the time what MacArthur had done and where he had gone? Were you guys aware of it, or did that not come till later?
We knew it day by day, everything. Yeah. We had fondness for Wainwright. He would go up the front lines. He would leave the tunnel in Corregidor and go up and check the units and so forth and so on. And he was more or less in charge of the whole thing. And MacArthur was holed up in the Malinta Tunnel. He never peeped out. We call him Dugout Doug. As everybody gets nicknames. Anyway, we heard about him getting a call from Washington and having to go to Australia. I don't feel bad about it. I think it was a wise decision, and the system that they used to retake the Philippines and all of the islands in that area were, I think they were the right ones.
Well, and maybe the lens of history has helped you understand that his strategic importance and what ended up happening, it was important for him to be saved. But at the time, I'm sure there was some grumbling among the troops that, here, your leader in this area of the war is bailing out on you.
That's right. Well, we just lived from day to day, mainly just standing there waiting for action. It was boring. Really, it was boring. Months after months of just waiting for action. I was smoking. I'd raised my intake from a carton, I don't know, a week or so, to 2 or 3 cartons a week. Just nothing to do but smoke cigarettes and just look up in the sky. Right after that bomber, drive bomber, dropped that bomb and ruined us, one of our guys, the next day, Bataan surrendered. Well, before that happened, the night before, it was still daylight, and Jack Ellis, who was the commander, he was a first lieutenant, and our captain had been wounded that day. Jack Ellis was a personal friend of mine, and he said, "Bill, go down to headquarters, down the trail, and find out what to do. Our communications are out. Our telephones are out. We've been bombed, and they were destroyed, and we don't know what to do." And so I picked up 2 other guys. One of them was the son of the principal of Albuquerque High School. So we went down this dark trail. We had our guns with us. And about real dark, we got down to headquarters, and they were all loading up in trucks and command cars and heading south for the bottom end of Bataan. And I asked, he was a colonel, I said, "What are we supposed to do, Battery B?" He said, "Hell, I don't know what to tell you to do. Use your own damn judgment." So I'd walked all that distance and gotten a negative answer. And so I had to turn around and go right back up the trail, and it turned dark by that time. And shells were coming over from Corregidor. Shells were coming overhead from the Japanese, and they were bombing Corregidor, shelling Corregidor. And we got back up to the battery midnight. The moon was out, bright as day, and we could look over in the bushes over there, and we could just imagine the Japs are over there. And we checked the guns, and the M4 director, the height finder, and everything had been ruined, scuttled, damaged, ruined. The Japs couldn't use it. So we turned around and went right back down the trail. We got down almost to the water's edge and laid down on the ground to take a break. It's daylight. The ground started to shake. Earthquake.
Wow.
The land had the same reception as we had. Negative. We got up and kept walking. And myself and one other guy, one of them took off and went someplace else. We got down to the water's edge, and there was a boat out there just aimed towards Corregidor. and I had about 30 guys on the deck. It was a flat-top motor launch is what it was. And so we waded out and got on the boat, and the boat took off. We got about halfway over to Cregador. Uh-oh, here comes three dive bombers looking for trouble, and we were trouble. So we took our guns and aimed, and somebody on our boat said, "Put your damn guns down," as if we didn't aim our guns, they wouldn't aim their guns. Well, somebody's kind of foolish, not very good leadership. So we put our guns down, and I figured, well, I'm right on the stern, and they're going to come. And here came one plane, peeled off, and came down at us. And I thought, well, is he going to drop a bomb, or is he going to shoot us with a machine gun? If it's a bomb, it's going to get us. If it's a machine gun, well, maybe if I jump in the water and get as deep as I could get, those bullets won't reach me. So that's what I was going to do.
Mm-hmm.
So here come the plane, and here come the machine guns. We looked up. Oh, he's not shooting. What's happening? Oh, a PT boat right over there. Had twin 50 caliber guns on the front and twin 50s on the back, and he was shooting at that plane, and that plane chickened out, pulled away, and left us alone. We got all the way to Cregador without getting killed.
PT boat saved you.
Saved my life. You bet it did.
Well, and your decision to get on that boat maybe saved your life. Is that a stretch, or am I correct in thinking that if you guys had not found that boat and had been stuck on Bataan, that you would have been swept up in the death march yourself?
Exactly. Of course, we didn't know anything about the death march at that time, but that's exactly what happened. Everybody that was on Bataan that surrendered made the death march. Or if they were sick, like in a hospital or something like that, they used trucks, American trucks, and took them to the camp. I got to Corregidor, but I was only there for a day or so.
Mm-hmm.
And I walked through Melinda Tunnel, and I saw Wainwright and how terrible he looked with all the pressure and the war and so forth. And they sent us over that night to Fort Hughes, which was another mile or two off of the tip of Corregidor.
Just another little island?
Little island.
So how many people are on this island?
Fort Hughes was another fortified island with 12-inch mortars. And those 12-inch mortars were all facing Manila Bay. And they had been put in and developed right after the Spanish-American War to keep any of the Spanish-American or any other country from bringing in ships to capture Manila.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically all there was on the island that I knew of. They had tunnels that were manufactured out of the rock formations. They had the ammunition in the tunnels, and we ate and we slept in the tunnels, and we existed in the tunnels most of the time.
So your job was to be there and defend that land should the Japanese approach, or to be taking shots at Japanese airplanes, or what were you guys doing there?
Well, they had 3-inch guns, anti-aircraft guns there on Fort Hughes, just like we were used to using. But when we got there, well, they had so many other soldiers and the original soldiers. It's either the 60th or the 59th Regiment that was there on a permanent basis. They were regular army, and they were there full time before the war even started. But they operated the guns, and we didn't have anything to do. All we did is just stand around and watch and look and try to hide. Anyway, this one day we were out on the beach, my buddy and I, Eastern Beach, and here came a formation of Japanese ships, heavy bombers. They were flying high because they had learned that if they flew at a certain elevation, that the 3-inch guns could not reach them. It was due to the fact that we had World War I fuses in our ammunition called powder train fuses. It's the same thing they used for blowing up dynamite.
Mm-hmm.
And they were just could not do the job. But anyway, we looked up, saw the planes, and we said, well, they're coming over. They're not going to bomb us. They're going to bomb Corregidor, which is just a couple miles up. After a few minutes, well, they were closer and bombs had not dropped yet, but I decided, well, you know, why don't we just play safe? And there's a box in the sand that's a little concrete box. I'd never seen them one like that. I didn't know what it was for. There was no wiring in it or anything else, but it was big enough for two guys to get in. We got in them, and guess what? A bomb hit within 15 feet of that box. It was probably a 500-pounder, and it blew a hole in the sand as deep as a man standing in the bottom and holding his hand up, and his hand would be even with the ground level.
That's a big crater.
It saved our lives.
Well, there are a few of those moments in your story. We've heard a couple of them already, and there's another. As the days went by, and obviously that's a close call that gets your attention, but were you starting to wonder when, not if, you'd be captured? Or tell me how that all unfolded when you finally realized that your future was going to be pretty uncertain as a prisoner of the Japanese.
Well, along with that flight of planes that went over, that was just a tiny bit in the bucket to what Corregidor was receiving. And we were watching every day the bombers going over and bombing Corregidor. And before we'd come over to Fort Hughes, we'd spent one night in a magazine. And we had, for sleep partners, we had 3, 5, 7, 12-inch ammunition. It was a magazine, what it was. And we found that the Japs were also shelling from Bataan, from the tip of Bataan. Now, that was the primary reason that the death march was conducted, is to get the American soldiers away from where Corregidor was shelling back. So they started the death march, and they gave the soldiers the orders to get these guys up. In the first place, they didn't realize how many prisoners there was. And they thought there were many fewer prisoners, both Filipinos and Americans. But they were amazed at how many there were. We saw all of this going on. One day, we heard an explosion on Corregidor, and we heard a tremendous boom. And I looked over there, and there was a big, one of the shells had blown up one of those magazines, and a big chunk of concrete was flying through the air, hundreds of feet in the air, just slow motion from the explosion, and they had hit this magazine that had all the ammunition in it.
You mean like the one you'd been sleeping in?
Exactly. Exactly. The same thing. Anybody that was even close to that magazine is no longer with us. And the Japs would shell with high explosive, and then they'd shell some duds, and the duds would penetrate that concrete. Now, a lot of people don't know the facts of Corregidor, but when they rebuilt Corregidor after the Spanish-American War, they poured a lot of concrete. They didn't have water, so they used seawater. Now, if you know anything about concrete, I've got a degree in concrete, you do not use salt water in concrete. You don't get any strength at all. And instead of 3,000-pound concrete, you're getting 1,500-pound concrete, or maybe 500-pound concrete. The concrete was porous. You just keep shelling the thing, and eventually it'll poke a hole through it and go inside. And that's what happened. Then we were captured. We saw the day that Corregidor surrendered, they had the white flag up. And we said, uh-oh, we're going to get it. And they'll probably come over tonight. And sure enough, they did. The Japanese sent a boat over. One of our majors went out and met them and talked to them and surrendered Fort Hughes as well. And we were captives. We were in the tunnel, one of the tunnels, when the Japanese came in that night. The ugliest looking soldiers you ever saw. Bow-legged, ugly looking soldiers, little guys. But we knew damn well we better keep our mouths shut, because we had taken our rifles and stood them up and stacked them in a triangle, and we didn't know whether we were going to get killed, massacred, or just what. But we were standing along one side of the little tunnel, and they walked in. One guy was carrying a machine gun, and another one was carrying ammunition, and they came in, and we did what they told us to do. And the next day, well, we were looking for food, looking for water, and we ended up, we were taken over back to Corregidor to a place called 92nd Garage. And we were there for about 13 days until the Japs got a ship ready. They took us over to Manila. Then they paraded us down the main street of Manila and bragging about how good soldiers they were and so on and so forth. And we went along with it. You bet we did. We didn't stick our necks out or do anything we shouldn't do. We ended up at the main hospital there in Manila.
Bill Overmeyer would spend the next 3 years as a prisoner of war.
We worked 9 days and got the 10th day off. Now, fleas and lice were rampant. You cannot believe going through life with insects crawling inside your clothes. We spent the day off, taking our clothes off, turning them inside out, finding the lice. They didn't jump, but we could catch them and pop them between our thumbnails. Well, later on, it turned into fleas. We'd find a flea, and about the time we'd start to pop him, well, he'd jump. We'd never catch him. But we slept on a straw mat. It was raised up off of the floor, and that's where they came from, I guess. We didn't know where they were. The food was bad, bad, bad. We had 3 meals a day. We had grain. First of all, we had wheat, and they'd make biscuits. And, we loved those. But they didn't last more than a couple of months, and then we were on rice. Used rice, white rice, barley, korea. We called it korea. It was a reddish-colored grain, and we didn't know what it was, and soybeans, and that was it. We didn't know what it was. It was keeping us alive, but everybody met the diet, unless you worked in the kitchen or something like that, and you got all you wanted. And we never got that. We had 2 meals a day, the breakfast and supper, and it was that grain, and that's all it was.
And not large quantities, I'm sure.
Oh, no. Everybody got the same ration. We had one man that's captured late in camp, and he was a subject from Ireland, and one of the naval companies. He was captured on a naval ship, and he had the best build on him, just like a bodybuilder today that you have seen. Man, he looked beautiful. In 6 months, he was dead. He couldn't adjust to that diet, and it was a case of adjusting. I got down to 60 kilos or even less, which is 132 pounds, but I had not lost the weight that, say, a six-footer or anybody that weighed over that weight, you know. Either you adjust or you don't. But we had many diseases. Beriberi was one of them. Pellagra was another. And a lot of guys had malaria. And it was just unbelievable. Boy, we'd eat anything we could get. Anything. There were no dogs, there were no cats, there were no anything around that was edible. We ate it.
How was it that you were liberated, and what was that glorious day like for you?
Well, we had the same problem eating what little there was to eat at this prison camp. One day after work, the commandant, who was, we found out that he was a principal at the high school. Huh. And he spoke a little English.
Uh-huh.
And we went into the mess hall, just the officers and the non-commissioned officers. And he got up in front, he said, "Peace is smiling." We said, "What'd you say?" "Peace is smiling, goo. The war is over, goo." Hallelujah. That place went up in smoke. He said, "Don't tell the men. Keep it quiet, please." We said, "Yes, we will." Until we got out the door. And we told everybody else as quick as we could.
How do you keep that news to yourself, right? What is it that you want to keep alive? What's the history that you think your kids and grandkids and great-grandkids need to remember? What makes that so important?
When I was at UNM in the National Guard, and we went down to Fort Bliss, I looked one day at how many guys came from the University of New Mexico. And I've made some ridiculous statements, I think. I think half of the male population of the University of New Mexico was in the National Guard. And all of them were down there at Fort Bliss with me. Well, I know that hell ships killed a tremendous number of them. The death march killed a bunch more. But to think that I firmly believe that less than half of our boys came home. In other words, we had a nominal 2,000 personnel. Half of that is 1,000 men. I believe there are anywhere from 900 to 1,100 of us died overseas. And that's a pretty big sacrifice. That's a pretty damn big mistake for the politicians in Washington, D.C. to allow a country get in such a bad state and the relationship with that country gets so bad that they send us out on the spear of the sword and then take the sword away from us. It's ridiculous.
Well, and if you don't learn from history, you're bound to repeat it, right?
That's right. That's exactly right. That's exactly what it's all about.
Is there anything else that I haven't asked you about that you think it's important for us to know?
I can't think of anything at the moment. I appreciate the privilege of being able to do this. I'm sure the guys that I know, personal friends, my closest friends that didn't come back, I'm sure they'd be grateful too. And that's the reason I do it.
To honor them.
Amen. Amen.
Bill Overmyer and Frank Paredes, two men who endured so much in World War II from start to finish. You can link to their complete original interviews and find photos of them at hometownheroesradio.com. That's all the time we have for this episode, but I hope you can join us again next time when we celebrate Black History Month with men who served in a segregated military in World War II. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.